Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy. Recording is 3:02 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is May 19th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. There's so many different competing themes in the markets right now that it's quite difficult to distill them. And there's this enthusiasm around artificial intelligence, and the enthusiasm we're seeing around it is very similar to the enthusiasm around the internet back in the 1990s. And there's some significant accelerations in shares like Nvidia, and then the beginning of some catch-up plays in other stocks within the sector. There's also the fact that the performance on the US stock market over the course of this year has been dominated by just five shares. They've contributed to 80% of the advance. So that's an exceptionally narrow breadth. Then we have the fact that gold prices are right in the region of the peak, and hovering around the $2,000 level and unwinding the short-term overbought condition, but still really quite steady, particularly compared to how quickly they got up there. Then you have the whole, what I can only describe as a circus around the discussion around the USA's debt ceiling and politicians flirting with the threat of default in order to, I think, well, on the one hand, it's to score political points. On the other, it is to, if you want to try and look at it from a positive perspective, it is trying to open a discussion about the trajectory of the unfunded liabilities. Then you can also start to think about this in terms of the bigger picture that the USA, with massive unfunded liabilities and a political class incapable of making big decisions, is walking into an environment where other countries are looking at it and thinking that the decadence has reached a point, or perhaps a tipping point. So you have the G7 meeting going on right now in Japan, and you have the major economies of the world with the deepest capital markets talking about cooperation, and also talking about how to counter the rise of the alliance between China and Russia. But then you have the BRICS summit is going to be in August, and that's going to be a meeting of countries like China and India and Russia, South Africa, and then all of these additional major emerging markets that have applied for membership of that informal group, particularly Saudi Arabia. So we're basically looking at the world being redrawn along new geopolitical lines, and that is something that is going to have a longer term effect, most particularly because a lot of those emerging market countries are suspicious of the motivation that the G7 have, or NATO has, or perhaps it might be even more correct to say that even the OECD has. It is worth considering that the OECD has a governance component to it, and many of those countries don't fit inside it. So when we then think about the kinds of trends that are underway, I thought that this ratio of the NASDAQ to gold is a good one, because the NASDAQ, and this is the NASDAQ composite, not just the NASDAQ 100, has been trending higher relative to gold now for the last decade. And last week it was hovering here and not quite able to push up through the 200-day or 1,000-day moving average, and this week it did. So it has now broken the sequence of lower rally highs, and that is definitely a testament to enthusiasm around this artificial intelligence idea. Now, it's certainly true that enhancements to productivity contribute to massive bull markets because it boosts economic potential, it creates value, Companies do exceptionally well because they have expanded markets and then they also gain efficiencies. So this then the whole promise around artificial intelligence is particularly profound. Now, I think it is most particularly relevant to highlight that companies like Nvidia are not cheap. So we're not talking about a value proposition here. This is a growth proposition. And the share has returned to test the peak from late 2021. We had this phenomenally large pullback in 22 and then this exceptionally steep rebound. Well, the statistic I saw quoted in a report earlier this week was that if Google, for example, were to implement artificial intelligence in its search, then it would increase its costs by a minimum of $30 billion a year, potentially upwards of $100 billion. That's the volume of additional computing power that Google would have to attain. And there is certainly a race on to create the large language model type of products that they can then leverage advertising on. And it does, I think, beg the question, the direction in which these things are going to take. Because in many respects, advertising isn't simply about making the potential customer aware of the unique characteristics of whatever product is being sold. But in many respects, it's lying to the customer. It's telling them that this is the best car, this is the best restaurant, this is, in my opinion, the best whatever. But of course, not, and the subjective is not the objective. So when we think then about what are the kinds of recommendations that an AI can give, then they will be subject to subjectivity. Then that is, of course, going to have an impact on how these evolve, what kind of search results come up. But then I think what's been happening in China is also particularly relevant. There was just this week a rather famous stand-up comedian pair, and they made a offhand remark about the it was basically that he had adopted two dogs. They were chasing squirrels, so they were working and not achieving anything. And that was similar to a statement that Xi Jinping made 3 years ago in a speech about the People's Liberation Army. So now those comedians have been cancelled. Now, this is obviously one, it's an indication of what free speech means in China. But then it raises important questions for how an AI can be generated. So will an AI have to go back and look at every speech that an important political figure has made and ensure that whatever references it makes are that it completely excises any kind of counter-argument from its results? So then we get into a rather odd situation that it really will depend on how these AIs are programmed. But then, of course, what it also holds out the prospect of is that you have a captive AI and you're training it on your data, the data that you want, to ensure that it comes up with the answers you want. But there are two potential outcomes. The first is that the AI itself, they do have these hallucinations, and that means that they can come up with answers that you don't exactly know how they came up with them. Now, that's problematic if you're a censor. Then, of course, there is the potential that your AI is hacked. And then, not simply hacked, but simply that additional new information is made available to train it on. Then you end up getting perversions in terms of the kind of answer you want if you're an autocratic type of country. So there's certainly a very large challenge, but the access to data is obviously going to be one of the more important points. And I think this is something that we're going to see new economic models built around. So if we think about the iterations of the global economy, we've had an agrarian society, which really put a monetary value on the productive capacity of land and horticulture, agriculture, and animal husbandry. And obviously, we all survive based upon the productivity from the agricultural sector. Then that was basically a system where gold and limited supply and was very accommodating. So then we had the gold standard. Now, the gold standard was then replaced by oil. So we've had the petrodollar system, and oil became the good for gold or good for the dollar and a fundamental backdrop for the global economy. Now, we all still use fossil fuels and energy, and it's an enormous benefit to society, and it has allowed the global population to expand at an incredible rate. And I think that we can think then about a lot of the promise that was made around Bitcoin. So I'm going to then think about this not so much in terms of the price of Bitcoin, because I believe the price of Bitcoin is more a reflection of liquidity. And I do think that this is important, that in the 1990s we used to pay for our internet browsers, and we used to get Encarta as an online encyclopedia as part of buying a computer. Or you'd have to buy Encarta. You'd have to pay for your internet browser. Then business models were created where it was simply given away for free, and then we just simply agreed to be marketed to. And that then made the internet a zero-cost game. And I think this is something that's important with Bitcoin, that the nominal price of the tokens is irrelevant if the underlying technology is efficacious and is providing a useful service. Now, the useful service argument, I think, is difficult to make because there is no killer app for Bitcoin or the cryptocurrencies. Now we have layer upon layer of innovation that's occurring, and there are smart contracts being developed and ledgers that are being created for recording transactions, and that is basically all it is an online ledger that is difficult to interfere with. So it's basically etchings on a brick wall that everybody can see around. There's always somebody watching, therefore it can't be changed. Well, but that's just the way that the market works. But the promise is that it is the digital asset is a value in itself, that there is a value to the network, and that the network itself is a value proposition, and that there will be products developed on top of it that will then become integral to the functioning of the global economy and will be so great that there will subsequently be a real way to value it in terms of currency and foreign exchange value. And I think that it is more likely that it is artificial intelligence and the productivity that is arranged as a result of that has the potential then to create more productivity growth, has to the clear potential that it is going to be the next iteration of the global monetary environment. And That doesn't mean that the shares have to go up in a straight line. That we can think about the evolution of the NASDAQ bull market. We had this huge advance in the shares like Cisco in the 1990s. And I think this is also relevant that Cisco is firming right now and it's steadying from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. But it's still considerably below where the peak was in 2000. Now, I think this is also quite relevant just to highlight how high the price to sales ratio went for Cisco back in 2000. So I like the price to sales ratio just as a measure of where the speculative interest is, because Cisco's went to 60 and then subsequently collapsed. And that was very much reflective of the crash in the NASDAQ and the fact that sales had been pulled forward from years in the future and then subsequently took decades to recover. Now, when we think about Nvidia, as I said, it is not a cheap share and it's trading on a price to sales ratio close to 30. Now, close to 30 is still half of the valuation that Cisco attained at the peak of the bubble in the late 1990s. Based upon that valuation comparison alone, there's potential that it might go further from here. But the other point, of course, is that we are still in a tightening liquidity environment. And the reality here is that interest rates have gone up enormously quickly. So, the promise of technology is I guess what happens is that there are two different cycles. There's the technology cycle and the internet, the interest rate cycle. When you have a technology cycle, then the people working in labs around the world, the people that are developing new products, these are generally done by reasonably small teams. And usually, then, it happens outside of the realm of the interest rate cycle. But stock markets are very much in, linked to what happens in terms of funding and interest rates. So, when you have low interest rates and you have abundant credit, and then corresponds with the technology sector, then you get really big bull markets. And that's exactly what we've had over the last 15 years. We've had a liquidity-driven bull market. And when we think then about the phenomenal increase in liquidity that we've had over this decade, then that has contributed to this huge run-up in the price of just about everything. So, when we think then about the Fed's bank term funding problem, so that's the let me see, BTFP. I do apologize. So, we've seen some liquidity boosting, and the response to the demise of some of the regional banks resulted in about $87 billion being drawn down from the Federal Reserve. But that has to be viewed in the context of the size of the Fed's balance sheet initially jumping and then contracting by over $280 billion. Or excuse me, 200, yes, 280 billion. So that's means that a lot of it has been sanitized, and the size of the Fed's balance sheet continues to contract. And then we can think about the total assets of central bank balance sheets redenominated into US dollars. And it contracted by about 10% in 2022. And then we had a little bit of a rebound in response to first the pensions crisis in the UK, then the regional banks crisis in the USA. And some of these central banks around the world are talking about the end of their interest rate hiking cycle, beginning to look past the war against inflation, and are starting to worry instead about what a recession might look like, and that could potentially represent a big jump in the size of the total assets of central banks. But for now, at least, it is rolling over, and it does look like it is going to contract further from here. So, in just the simple way of thinking about liquidity, we've had a huge run-up in liquidity. Now we're in a po at a point where we had a big contraction in 2022, and it's mostly been going sideways this year, but it is rolling over. So these are important considerations, because the most basic way of looking at markets is that it is simply easier to make money when there's a lot of money around. Now, one of the difficulties is that the size of central bank balance sheets went up so quickly, going up 150% in the space of little more than a year and a half. That's a phenomenally large infusion of cash, and there is still a lot of cash sloshing around. So that's contributing, for example, to the zero-day option trading, and this what I think can only be described as a casino-like environment. We can see that there is almost equal demand right now for calls and puts, and these are trading in really quite significant volume. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of options in some of these trades. So all expiring by the end of today. Now, the S&P 500 is testing its peak from earlier this year at 4,200. It has bounced from the region of the 200-day moving average, and that is looking like a bullish action overall. But the problem is that it's happening for a reasonably small number of shares, and the economy continues to slow down. So I think it's useful to think about artificial intelligence philosophically, to think about the incredible opportunity that it represents, the incredible potential for deep learning, and the ability of computer systems to ask questions that we don't even think about, which are, I think, very important considerations. And that we can have a step change in productivity, that there will be an incredible opportunity for growth. There will also be these challenges in terms of redeploying people and finding things for more white-collar workers to do. And of course, that is going to create difficulties in terms of the tax base, in terms of finding things for people to do. And obviously, those are big questions. And the smaller questions, the more urgent questions, are what's going to happen when we have the consumer being tapped out? And I thought it was interesting that, and people are playing with these AIs all the time. One of them I saw last week was saying, how do I save money? And then the AI said, well, let's connect your bank account. Let's find out what you're actually spending your money on. And then it just listed all the subscriptions. So that was an innovation of the last decade, the subscription business model. And we can think about the originators of the subscription business model were the utilities, that they would provide you with electricity or gas or water on an ongoing basis, and you pay on a use basis. Then you started to see these innovations in the technology sector, where companies like Microsoft, which had been highly cyclical, and the technology sector was highly cyclical for a very long time. But then Microsoft innovated, and instead of being a company tied to the iteration of its software, and every new version would create a sales bump, which would then have to be serviced. They adopted a subscription business model, and as soon as that happened, well, then the share multiplied in value. And we've had a really incredible rebound over the course of the last several months as it has wholeheartedly, full-throatedly embraced artificial intelligence. They view that as a clear competitive advantage, as a massive productivity enhancement. I was My daughter last night was making a PowerPoint presentation about the book she's just read. And it took her a substantial amount of time. Whereas the presentation that the Microsoft tech guys made at the MIT Emerging Tech Conference a couple of weeks ago was that when this is released, you can simply have your text inputs, it will create your PowerPoint presentation for you. And I think that's an incredible labor-saving device. PowerPoint presentations take forever to put together. So this is obviously a potential outcome. But what we are definitely going to see is a winnowing process, that some companies will thrive. Others are going to have an exceptionally difficult time. What I find most especially interesting is that within the holdings of ETFs for artificial intelligence, Adobe is one of those companies. But Adobe is probably the company that has most at risk from being disrupted, because the chatbots can basically do everything that it sells. And the kinds of subscriptions that Adobe sells are really expensive. So the share has steadied, and it is holding a sequence of higher reaction lows, and I would personally be amazed if it gets back to that $700 level. I think that there is very clear potential that there are going to be a lot of disruptions. Then we can think about the fact that at the moment you have to buy subscriptions to gyms, and now AIs can give you a meal plan. They can tell you what you should be eating. So if we look at, for example, Weight Watchers, it's a company that has had a lot of volatility. Now it is just beginning to steady here. So the question, of course, is what's going to happen next? Are they going to be able to sustain the business model? Are they going to be able to deploy a chatbot to help people to abide by a new eating regime? Now that could potentially be something that could sell. Or will they be completely outsourced and will simply AI take over from their eating plan and simply adopt it? Now, of course, that also means that AI will look at all the different eating plans on the internet and come up with the best one for each individual person, and all of that self-help type of business will simply disappear. So this isn't really about the demise of the mom-and-pop shop. That was what disintermediation was in the 1990s. What's more likely here is that more substantial companies that have been trading within a niche that depended on the provision of a service that was unique to them, but that could be taken over by an AI, they're going to disappear. And we're definitely seeing some speculative activity at the moment around depressed shares. Now, then there will be companies that benefit. And Dynatrace is an interesting one, that it popped on the upside with stronger earnings in here this week. And what they're basically doing is talking about, they've developed these automatic programming systems, so they can look for errors in code and fix it within cloud architecture. And CS Disco has got an AI type program that is aimed squarely at the law profession. So they make it much easier to find case examples for lawyers through using this product. And the share also began to steady in here today, or at least this week. And that was on somewhat better earnings. But of course, we've had a phenomenally large decline for some of these companies. And then we've also started to see some of the more cautious companies beginning to attract interest. So C3 has at least steadied in the region of the 200-day moving average. However, I would say that for a company with a ticker AI, the fact that the CEO is going around telling people that they refuse business and that they're very cautious about who they work with, that's not great news when you don't make money. So there is still a very clear benefit to companies that are embracing AI. Now, I am very conscious of the fact that we do have tighter liquidity conditions, that bond yields are still uncomfortably high, and that we have this environment where the Federal Reserve is talking about pausing in June, but still very much attached to their view that they're not going to be cutting rates anytime soon, or potentially not until 2024. So that's going to hold rates higher for longer. And the longer those rates stay high for, the greater the pressure will come on marginal buyers or marginal borrowers. So the high yield ETFs, they remain under pressure and still holding the sequence of lower rally highs. Now, it definitely steadied this week, and we do have the succession of higher reaction lows. So that at least is suggesting that there is steadier action within the high yield sector. And the regional banks are rolling over. And I think, well, they were weaker in early trading today and still holding around the $40 level. There is potential that they can unwind the short-term oversold condition. But I think it's important to highlight there's two important things about commercial real estate. The first is that it's a fraction the size of the residential real estate market. So there isn't the potential that it's going to turn into a 2008 style problem, although it could certainly become a problem for pension funds and the owners of commercial property, which are generally the large institutional investors and the private equity groups. And then there is the additional statistic that the lenders for commercial property are regional banks. They account for approximately 40% of the lending that goes into the commercial real estate market because they tend to bet on their local municipalities. And it's more relationship banking. So that gives them local exposure. They're supposed to know what their local economy is like, and then they make decisions about the kinds of buildings they're willing to lend on. But it does mean that the regional banks are more exposed to the stay-at-home phenomenon. So the work-from-home phenomenon is not going to be appropriate for everyone. And I know that this must sound odd, coming from someone like me, because I've been working from home since 2007. But I would be the first to say that you do not work at home, you live at work. And if you don't adopt that type of mentality, then working from home is not going to be as productive, and then companies are not going to be happy for workers to do that. We're definitely seeing then that also there is the reality that I basically work on my own and I don't need to be in a team and I don't have to talk and I don't have to do meetings all that often. So That's also, of course, very different from the majority of businesses where meetings happen all the time, and particularly client meetings. So these are obviously key differences. What it basically means is that some businesses, some jobs are very appropriate for working from home and others just aren't. And of course, for companies like Tesla, JP Morgan, where they have been very clear in that they want their people back in the office, well, they certainly also need that more teamwork, collaboration type productivity. And that's very difficult to create on our online. So we are in this rather interesting scenario. Now, the enthusiasm around artificial intelligence and the productivity growth that that can enhance, that's certainly beneficial for advanced economies and the technology sector more generally. And particularly when you don't have a growing population, then finding productivity enhancing solutions is a really big benefit. But then we have the rest of the world and the debt. And the question that's not really talked about in terms of the debt ceiling in the USA is the fiscal situation. And the USA's cost of servicing the national debt is surging higher. And we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars. And the higher that, or the longer that yields stay higher for, the more of a problem that becomes because so much of the USA's debt is short dated. And that basically just ensures that the volume of debt is going to have to increase because they're not really talking about fiscal consolidation. There are simply too many big items on the budget that are non-negotiable. And this is problematic. When you cannot talk about Social Security, you can't talk about Medicare or Medicaid, then obviously that becomes problematic, and then you have one party that wants to continue to enhance defense spending. So that basically means that money printing is going to continue, and that the debt ceiling will be addressed, and more money will be forthcoming. Now, gold is in the region of its all-time highs because the USA is also deploying the dollar as a weapon, and they confiscated Russia's sovereign reserves. Now, that was a really big event that hasn't really had a lot of longer-term consequences yet. But the sudden burst of interest in BRICS and membership of that grouping is a result of this weaponization of the dollar. And countries certainly are more interested now in transacting between one another in currencies other than the US dollar. And given the growth rates that emerging markets have relative to one another, then that is something that is going to become a growing theme. And central bank buying of gold has certainly picked up as well as they diversify away from dollars. So geopolitical lines are being drawn, and a clear marketing exercise is underway to try and encourage emerging markets to be more aligned with the OECD than with China and Russia. And at gold is becoming more of a reserve asset from the perspective of emerging market governments. So when money printing does pick up, and it will pick up, because when the debt ceiling question is solved, they're going to issue at least $1 trillion of new debt and within the first couple of days. And then it'll only go higher from there. So the dollar index has rebounded and is now testing the region of the 200-day moving average. And I think that this is very important. It's a potential area of resistance. And I think it's also very relevant that the dollar has tended to move in these long-term cycles. And we had 7 years on the upside and 7 years on the downside and a couple of years of messing around and 7 years on the upside and 7 years on the downside and a few years of messing around. And now we're on the upside for 8 years. The dollar's uptrend is long on the tooth. And we're now back testing the 100 level. We've had a rebound from that area. So it hasn't broken down yet. But if it sustains a move down through the 100 level and the 1,000-day moving average, well, then I think we'll have pretty good evidence that the dollar's trend has been broken. And that could then lead to the dollar trending downwards into approximately 2030. And it would take the index down to new lows, which would mean that the dollar exceeds the low put in 2008. Now, if that happens, then the price of gold will double, and we will see new all-time highs in very robust fashion. We will also see gold breaking out on a purchasing power parity basis. And I do think that is going to be the clear confirmation of a new bull market overall. So we have gold steadying right now on a purchasing power parity basis, but it's not breaking out. And when it does break out, that will be a very pivotal event. Now, something that I've been thinking about in terms of that purchasing power parity is looking at commodities on an inflation adjusted basis. So feeder cattle is pushing up to new highs. But on an inflation-adjusted basis, just simply by, or maybe perhaps we should look at it on a purchasing power parity basis. And certainly hopes helps if you type correctly. So if we adjust feeder cattle for purchasing power parity, now we have to do it the other way around and multiply. Now we get a very similar situation overall. So, in nominal terms, feeder cattle are starting to appreciate. In purchasing power parity terms, they're not even at the highs from a couple of years ago. We've had a big move higher in soybeans, and soybean prices have been coming down. So, on a purchasing power parity basis, the food price hasn't really moved. Or we can say the same thing about corn. We've had a big move in corn, but not on a purchasing power parity basis, particularly relative to the kinds of very expensive food that we had in the 1970s. Then let's look at oil, because obviously there is a big question about the oil price. So Brent crude on a purchasing power parity basis has actually held up much better than those agricultural commodities. It is substantially above 1990, and I think that definitely helps the real money value of oil. That the price of oil has appreciated over time, and that we've had these steps higher, we've had long trading ranges, but on aggregate, oil prices have rallied. Now, I think that eventually we are going to have a way of valuing data that will have a monetary value, and that will be a new iteration of global growth and productivity. But that's a long-term way of thinking, and I don't believe it is logical to talk about it just yet as a reality. It's a potential, but it's not a reality. I don't think anyone has really figured out yet how that could be measured in economic terms, and whoever does will probably win a Nobel Prize. So that's probably something that's out there on the horizon 20 years, 30 years from now. What I'm concerned about is that a lot of the potential for the next 10 years and 20 years is rapidly being priced into markets in an environment where liquidity conditions are tight. What it suggests to me is that there will be better buying opportunities, and that what we're looking at right now are momentum opportunities, and that one would be well advised to have stops. Now, oil prices are in fact trending downwards on a purchasing power parity basis and on a local currency basis too. So this, I think, is one of the more important points, that oil prices have been mostly going sideways for 20 years and are coming back down to the lower side of that range. There's a lot of questioning about where the money should go to invest, and we're in an environment where fossil fuel investment is difficult to do publicly. So it's relying on private markets. And then you have the countries like Saudi Arabia, where they want to sustain a higher price, and so does Russia. But now that the USA is also an exporter, they have a vested interest in prices staying higher for longer. But the big difference, of course, is that the USA is private oil, and they have a responsibility to their shareholders rather than their government. And I think that is a very key difference. So I don't believe that oil prices are likely to surge higher unless we have a very big supply disruption. I think that there will be much greater international competition. Now, I posted an article today from the Associated Press talking about the debt that China has lent out to various emerging markets and the difficulties that those countries are having in meeting their obligations. And in some cases, there have been secret escrow accounts created where China could literally dip into their pockets and take their money. So, on the one hand, you have the USA using the dollar as a weapon. And on the other, you have China using debt as a weapon. And in between, it is the smaller emerging markets are going to be squeezed. And there is both a carrot and a stick approach to currying favor with those smaller economies. Then the Chinese economy is definitely having issues with trying to deflate their property bubble. And the challenge right now, and I guess the biggest counter argument to the contention that the dollar is going to trend downwards for 7 years, is what currency is going to trend up against it. The problem here is that the Chinese property developers are trending down again, and there's another 10 billion in defaults that's being lined up now. Relative to the size of the economy, relative to the size of some of the liabilities that are outstanding in the world today, 10 billion is not a lot of money. But the bigger picture here is that the Chinese administration no longer sees infrastructure development as a benefit in terms of its economic production. And tying smaller countries to its orbit is certainly part of the reason for the Belt and Road Initiative in the first place. But China's hoarding cash right now, and certainly thinking about how they can sustain their economic potential. And the renminbi, having weakened for most of the week, was a little bit steadier in here today. And I do think that China is more likely to export deflationary forces than inflation. And one of the reasons why the copper price has been under pressure is because of less Chinese economic activity. But this, I think, is the one of the things that's underappreciated by many people. There is a huge question about the evolution of the energy sector, and you have the promise of demand for copper doubling, tripling over the course of the next 10 years on the back of mass electrification. One of the things that is problematic from that perspective is there just isn't the copper. So in order for that to happen, China would have to consume less. Now, China, of course, wants to build that energy infrastructure and be the major supplier of it. They will then have to stop using copper in infrastructure development and redeploy it into manufacturing. If that happens, then that could put some downward pressure on copper prices, or at least hold copper prices in a range and allow the energy transition to occur. Assuming that China is going to continue to build at the same pace and that demand growth for copper will grow on top of historic Chinese demand, I think is a mistaken conclusion. Now, then there is an additional question, and I think there was I was reading an article this week, and it was looking at ChargePoint. So, ChargePoint is one of the biggest owners of charging infrastructure for EVs anywhere, and they have a major problem that at any one time about a quarter of their chargers don't work, and there are lots of different challenges with that. Sometimes it's simply that they don't do well in the heat or cold, and sometimes it's that they're not robust enough, and sometimes they're vandalized, sometimes they're not internet connected, and sometimes their payment processes don't work. And that's fine when there's only a couple of thousand cars on the road. When there are a million cars on the road, or 10 million, or 100 million cars on the road, then the charging infrastructure has to work. And we can think about how often do you go to a petrol station and not, and one of those petrol pumps is not working. And any refilling station where a quarter of the petrol pumps were not working on a consistent basis would simply go out of business because people would stop going there. And I think this is a problem for the scaling of the EV market, that it's really for homeowners, and the charging infrastructure has to be produced and installed in places where people live. And if that's not going to happen, then the rollout isn't going to be as quick. But that also means that copper demand is not going to be as high. So that's why we're not seeing the big move higher in copper prices. Even if there is continued demand for the metal, it's not going to be as quick. I think this is one of the big challenges. And then we also have the fact that nickel prices have been trending downwards, and so has zinc. And these are major components in the batteries. So that's not a bullish activity. But what we did see over the last few weeks is that there has been more demand for platinum as a component in catalytic converters. Now, that's probably more a reflection of the fact that most palladium comes from Russia and Norilsk Nickel is a sanctioned security. So automotive manufacturers have to retool, finally retool, and are using much cheaper platinum than palladium. But what it might also suggest is that the reality is that the rollout of electric vehicles is going to be slower than the more bullish forecasts, and then that we're not going to have the same kind of upward pressure on commodity prices. So I think this is certainly something that we need to pay attention to. And then we can think about the very clear need to get inflation under control. The only possible way to meet the obligations that governments have built up for themselves is to bring inflation down. Of course, then you have the opposite contention with Japan, where most of the debt is owned by the government, and they're desperate to get inflationary pressures underway once more. So they're continuing to hold their quantitative easing program and trying to inflate the economy, and the stock market is responding. And the Nikkei has now broken successfully above 30,000 and is a clear recovery candidate. And this is quite a consistent trend overall, where we have a succession of ranges, one above the last. And the next potential area of resistance is going to be somewhere around 35,000. And there's certainly more interest in the hedged exposure to Japan right now, because a lot of this move is due to the devaluation of the currency. Now, the hedged fund is overbought in the short term, and the yen was a little steadier in here today, but the Japanese economy is still mired in a deflationary way of thinking. And I can give you a very good example of that, because we were in Japan and talking to pearl providers about 4 years ago. And we were thinking about the potential. Mrs. Tracy was thinking that having an oyster opening store might be a business opportunity. And there are businesses that do that in Japan. And going to them and asking for a quote, we were met with the response that they have enough business and they don't want any more, and that they weren't going to expand because it was too risky. And that's about the opposite of an inflationary mindset, that when you've got a deflationary mindset, everything is good enough and there's no need to plan for tomorrow because prices and levels and consumption will be lower in future. And then, of course, what happens when the owners of those businesses age out and they simply disappear and your economy contracts even further? So Japan is desperate to get an inflationary mindset moving again. And they are devaluing their currency in an attempt to reignite inflationary pressures. They're basically seeing this as a generational opportunity, because they were trying to get inflation moving for a long time, and it was practically impossible given that the global economy was in a long-term disinflationary period. And now that inflation is back on a global basis, Japan is grasping this opportunity to get inflation moving again with both hands. And I think with that, I'll leave you for this week, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.